Welcome to Inside Track. Santa Aurelia LLC is solely responsible for its content and pays for it. The views and opinions expressed on Inside Track are those of the host and guests and not necessarily endorsed by KVOI or its advertisers, but they should be. And now here's Bruce Ash.
Wow.
Hello, insiders, and a very pleasant good afternoon to you, wherever you may be. This is your host, Bruce Ash, along with co-host
Eb Wilkinson,
welcoming you all to a special Freedom Against Tyranny edition of Inside Track. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Good to have you with us. Eb, is your Christmas shopping done yet?
Oh, my God, I haven't even started.
Oh, man, you're one of those guys, huh?
I am.
Okay, now, Tammy's not listening to the show, is she?
Tammy is not listening to the show.
Can you share? Did you get her something nice?
The only thing I got her is a wonderful weekend away.
Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it is.
Well, it's better than me. Jane's birthday was last Sunday, and I won't tell you how old she is, but we've
32
known
again.
We've known each other since she was 5 and I was 7.
Wow.
I think she is just as beautiful today as when we first started dating in high school. And now Janie has sort of got gypped because of when her birthday occurs, either right before or right after Hanukkah. You know, the whole Jewish calendar thing is a little goofy.
So now, she gets 9 gifts.
Well, not exactly. So this year, her birthday was right in the middle of Hanukkah. And, you know, I'm a real romantic. And in fact, I'm a super romantic about my wife's birthday. And as you know, I'm sort of a sensitive kind of guy. And I listened to my wife's gift wishes, and not to be outdone from 2 years ago when we woke up on her birthday morning. And I said, hey, let's go out and pick your birthday gift.
What'd you get her?
Eb, I got her a cemetery plot.
Your love is forever.
My love is forever. I said, hey, honey, this is your birthday. We'll go out and pick out your cemetery plot. And yes, indeed, very romantic. And do you know anybody more romantic than me?
And not like that.
No, not at all. Not at all. I know some of you might
think. And she's still with you.
Yeah, pretty much. We spend a lot of time apart from each other. I actually think that's a good thing, you know? That kind of separation thing. And, you know, you may think, oh, that guy, Bruce, he's awful. Well, you'd probably be right. I know for the rest of you guys out there listening, I set a low bar with that birthday present.
Can't get lower.
Yeah, so this year, okay, and 2 years ago I got her a car, okay?
But, well, that's not bad.
But so with that low bar, we live real close to the Rita River off of Old Fort Lowell. We have a large grove of very mature 30-foot tall oak and sycamore trees growing outside of our backyard. Huge trees that really suffered in our long, hot, dry summer with no rain. Well, a few weeks ago, we hear a large bang. We didn't know what it was at the time until we walked outside later and found a huge branch had fallen on a trellis and another had damaged an oak tree, actually also in our backyard itself. And all of this made me think, hey, you're Mr. Romantic. Your dear wife has been nagging you for at least 2 years to arbor the trees and get some protection for the house from the trees, reduce a fire threat. Want to be thought of as the greatest husband in the world? Yep. Get the tree guys out and give my wife a birthday Hanukkah gift she's been wishing for 2 years. Give her a December to remember, like they say on the TV ads. Get her the gift of tree trimming.
Such a romantic.
Yep.
For Tammy's birthday, I got her a cord of firewood.
Nice.
She was ecstatic.
That's practical. That's
it
practical.
Is.
Hey, we're going to go ahead and we're going to welcome our first guest a little early because I want to try to get a whole bunch of stuff in. But let me just tell you, we have Bob Wells coming up. We're going to talk about national security. After the break, at the bottom of the hour, we're going to finish up today with a tribute to the men who fought at the Battle of the Bulge. That battle started on December 16th, 76 years ago. So we'll talk to award-winning and best-selling author Frank Lavin about his book, From Homefront to Battlefront, and the story of his father who fought in the forest there with the 84th Army Infantry Division. This portion of the show has been brought to you by Essential Pest Control. Essential Pest Control, professional service you can depend upon from a company you can trust. So let's go ahead, Tom. We're going to take Bob. Are you there, buddy?
Yes, good afternoon. Good to hear from you.
Oh, good. Bob's here.
thanks for taking time to call in today. Hey, insiders, if you're a regular listener to Inside Track, you know Mr. Wells is a retired Navy captain, served VP Dick Cheney as one of his national security advisors, and we're very fortunate to call upon him frequently for our own national security updates, especially on the Chinese threat to our country. He's also the author of the book Voices from the Bottom of the South China Sea, kind of a cool book, and he's a contributor you may see from time to time on national security issues on cable TV shows. Before we get into Bob, the articles from National Security Advisor O'Brien and DNI Chief John Ratcliffe, I want to ask this to you. Earlier this week, we learned that a former presidential candidate, a serving member of Congress, and member of the House Intelligence Committee, Eric Swalwell of California, apparently had a relationship with a communist Chinese agent. The agent, Fang Fang, what an appropriate name, not only raised money for him in an election, he actually allowed her to influence, with an intern in his office. What sort of danger signals, and actually I think it's two interns in his office that came from this agent, what sort of danger signals does this sort of relationship create, do you think?
Well, I think it creates a danger to national security, to be sure, but in particular with Representative Swalwell. He's on the Intelligence Committee, and he has access to all the different sources and methods, as President George Herbert Walker Bush used to say, with regard to our what we see with China, what we see in terms of national security threats. So he's been compromised, is the bottom line. And whenever you have a member of Congress compromised, it should be looked into. I understand it is being looked into, but it goes beyond just removing him from the committee. He swears an oath to the Constitution of the United States. It brings forth his loyalty to the United States in particular. So I think he, now that the lights are on in the room, he needs to be referred to the Ethics Committee inside of Congress because of the access of Fang Fang, as she is known, as you mentioned, and also take this very, very seriously because of the Chinese intent and what they're trying to do to compromise his position in the United States, in his position of leadership.
So, of course, Swalwell isn't the only American official the Chinese have influenced, is he? Can you speak to their influence, for example, on university academics, think tank officials who have been on this Chinese payroll in a number of quasi-official organizations, and what that could mean to American security?
Yes, in fact, if you look at on campus itself and look at what's happened with the Chinese espionage, actually, in quite a few areas. You've had the intent of the students and people that have access to information to basically exploit our intellectual property rights and exploit military secrets and push them back not only to the Communist Party of China, but also to the People's Liberation Army. So the more they get willing participants and people that are loyal to China in our academic community, in our national security enterprises, including some of the departments in our government, if you look at some of the institutes and some of the different areas that they've had access to with regard to business in particular, shell companies, those are very concerning. I do think because of the larger policy framework over the last 50 years, where we are looking at the peaceful rise of China, looking at where Henry Kissinger, Richard Nixon was back in 1972, where we are now with President Trump, really turning the lights on in the room and looking at what the Chinese have been doing in trade and cyber and on the campuses, we find that we need to be very realistic about China. We can't be idealistic about China with its peaceful rise and our original assumptions of looking at how they would be liberal and how they would basically be part of the world community as a stakeholder. They're actually going the other way with regard to ideology.
So we're going to go to a break and come right back. And just to kind of think about this during the break, National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien said last September that the greatest miscalculation in U.S. foreign policy since the 1930s, just as you said, Bob, has been the notion that as China develops, it would become a more liberal and in an economic sense and then politically more liberal. We could not have been more wrong. When we come back, I want to talk to you, Evan, I want to talk to you about maybe what the solution is. So let's go ahead and take a break, and we'll be right back with Robert Wells. Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. What other kind of customers do you have?
So our biggest customers are actually like ranchers and people from outside of the Tucson area. They're buying a lot of square tubing. They're buying a lot of stuff for their ranch to close off fences.
We'll sell anything from 10 feet to 10,000 feet to somebody that comes in because we have new steel and surplus steel from steel mills. The reason we're able to get such good pricing on some of this stuff is, A, we sell scrap to the mill. So we have a relationship there, and then we can buy material, what they're making, bringing it back. And so we save on freight, and we have relationships for years with them. So I think that's really our niche market. We'll sell whatever you need.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
It's termite season.
Bugs fear the blue trucks from Essential Pest Control.
Go blue at Essential Pest Control. We'll eliminate those bugs, bees, and termites. And stop paying too much to that national provider. Buy local for great service and affordable rates. Call Essential Pest Control because termites fear the blue.
Run for your life.
Call for the blue trucks from Essential Pest Control. 886-3029. That's 886-3029. Or check online at essentialpests.com.
I'm Eb Wilkinson with Imus Wilkinson Investment Management. I don't ever want you to be dependent on government ever again. I want you to become financially independent. You will never, ever have to depend on socialist security for your survival. We are here to guide you to financial independence. That's imuswilkinson.com, 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
Welcome back to Inside Track. This portion of today's show brought to you by that same guy you heard just a second ago, my co-host, Eb Wilkinson, and his partner, Gary Imus, from Imus Wilkinson Asset Management. Learn how to take the baby steps to financial security so you'll never be completely dependent upon socialist security. Call Eb or Gary at 777-1911. Robert Wells is here with us. I pose the question to you, Bob, regarding this gross miscalculation that America has made about the Communist Chinese Party and the People's Republic of China. What is there a single answer? Is there a simple answer to this dilemma that we have with them?
Well, I think American history really teaches us something. If you recall, Franklin Roosevelt during World War II focused on building that coalition with the Soviet Union and with Mr. Stalin, calling him Uncle Joe. But Harry Truman came in after the Second World War and had to look at the realities of the deeds of the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe. I think we just need to be realistic. I think what has happened under the Trump administration has been very helpful to the United States and to the American people. It's a little bit confusing, though, obviously, because of the need for us to trust. And we need to really trust our intelligence community. So when you have...
But
leaders,
can we?
I think so. I think I'm just with my national security hat on inside the bubble of Washington, D.C., where you're really looking at what the intelligence community is telling us from Mr. Ratcliffe, in particular, the DNI, you have to shape your policy response. And I think what we need to do going forward, using the sailor's analogy, is to maintain course and maybe pick up a little bit more speed. I really think that we need to affirm the reality of what China is. I don't think we can go back to a Mr. Clinton or a Mr. Obama-like engagement and enlargement national security strategy. I think Mr. Trump actually had it right in our national security strategy. I think we need to have what he called a principled realism, which just means, quite simply, we know our principles as Americans. We believe in freedom and democracy. Those are universal principles that have been around since the First World War with Woodrow Wilson. But in particular, our own constitutional fabric, our Bill of Rights, our freedoms themselves. And then be realistic and look how comprehensive China has been and continues to grow based on President Xi's leadership and what the CCP intends to do across all domains, the economic domain, military domain, the cyber domain in particular. And a key area is information warfare, or gray area domain. I really watch Taiwan very closely in terms of what's happening there. They're very close. They continue to bully. But looking at our relationship with China, they are challenging us. They are a competitor. And that's the right way to look at it in this particular new era of competitive geopolitical interface with all countries as China continues to branch out.
You say words are bullets. The real China, talks about their ideology. What does it mean, deny Taiwan? What does that mean exactly?
It means that looking at the original principles that were established during the Taiwan Relations Act, and looking at President Tsai and the Democratic Party of Taiwan, their intention to be free and independent, China does not want that. They feel emboldened by virtue of what they've achieved in Hong Kong with freedom and democracy, with their national security law. And they're looking at still the one China approach and looking at trying to subsume Taiwan, and to achieve that is to deny Taiwan their freedom, deny Taiwan their democracy. So they see Taiwan as a separate country or a separate part of China that needs to be brought back into the fold. So our particular position under the Taiwan Relations Act, what we believe in terms of our principled realism with freedom and democracy, the people of Taiwan are like-minded with the United States, and they want to have their own independent country, their own independent status. And China denies that by virtue of their capability with information operations. They call it gray zone warfare, in particular with the interdiction of aircraft in their airspace, the air defense zone of Taiwan, with the new surveillance aircraft, fighter aircraft, et cetera, as well as their expanding Coast Guard, which they're using on the high seas for what is termed as lawfare. There's a different way to actually determine their own will in China with this new Coast Guard, which is significant, protecting their new islands in the South China Sea, as well as the Senkakus areas around between Japan and Taiwan. But Bob, they're going to deny the free will of Taiwan.
Bob, what do you mean by the gray zone warfare?
It means they're going to use all of their elements of information with regard to listening to what Taiwan says and having an immediate response, looking at their cyber, social media on Taiwan, having different types of information to basically suppress Taiwan's influence in the world and international venues. For example, like their success that they've had with the COVID in Taiwan, the Chinese were able to deny access of Taiwan at the World Health Administration discussions which a free country or free ideas should have been exchanged. So they're taking the opportunity in a gray zone, not a hot war, not a cold war, to basically deny the influence that Taiwan could have and achieve their own prestige in the world by virtue of their democracy.
So they're pulling what the Democrats are doing with the canceling. They're trying to cancel Taiwan out.
That's exactly it. They're trying to minimize their influence, and they do this diplomatically as well, looking at when you have different countries that have other interests that are contrary to Taiwan, and you have Chinese influence, economic influence in particular, with their different initiatives, the One Belt, One Road initiative, which is going from both land and sea to the Middle East, to Europe for trade. You also are watching some of it occur in the Caribbean with regard to their access and influence economically, which translates into some countries that are recognized in China, and they used to have diplomatic recognition with Taiwan. So this is part of the actual gray zone war of influence to basically elevate China as the one China and to diminish Taiwan in the world diplomatic organizations.
Bob, we have a quick question from Robert. Robert, go ahead. You're on with Bob Wells.
Hey, Bob. They've been hacking us. We've been hacking them. At what point does all this cyber snooping become an act or a declaration of war?
That's a great question,
Robert. It depends on what the particular hacks are. In the Department of Defense, they have what they in cyber, they have what they call the ladder of escalation. It's like Mr. Ed. It's just EDD. On the bottom rung of the ladder is exploitation. On the D middle part of the ladder is denial of service, and the top level is destruction. While we're still working in the area, which I think the greater percentage are exploitation of information on the lower ladder of cyber intrusion and the denial of service, which is a little bit more serious. The Russians use this a little bit more, particular in the Baltics and also Ukraine. But the destruction is where I think the red line is drawn, where you're actually doing harm to the, for example, our national security, our key resources that we need for our electric grid. Also in the United States, it's really hard in this area, especially when you get into this exploitation, to rally around a particular cause. I think we're investigating that right now with the Orion intrusion. But I think that larger picture, Robert, that you ask about when, that's a national security issue. It would go to the National Security Council, and you would definitely have cyber evidence to basically demarche the Chinese, either in Washington, D.C., or a special emissary to China. But it would elevate rather quickly if it's a destructive cyber attack that would destroy certain key capabilities or national security capabilities in our country.
Thanks, Robert, for your question. Hey, Bob, I have a question with respect. This is the soft power that the Chinese are trying to exert around the world. With 1.4 billion Chinese consumers, American business wants to be able to expand their markets to a much wider version. Even the NBA, the threat last spring where the Chinese government forced the Houston Rockets GM to recant his comments about Uyghurs and their persecution, or risk losing the NBA from broadcasting games there. They forced NBA players to prop up the Chinese. They have not allowed American news organizations to operate there unless they kowtow to the Chinese. What do we do to stand up for the truth?
That's a great question, and I think we do have to stand up for the truth, and I think it's an education experience around the campfire. That's the best I can describe it. I think American companies and our sports, as well as our business leadership, our higher education leadership, they need to be informed of what is really going on. And you have to actually show the evidence of it actually happening. I think these are good case studies. In particular, you just brought up with regard to the Houston Rockets and the NBA, and you're actually seeing a case study that is the Communist Party, as well as their particular values, which are not ours, you know, which is totalitarian, Marxist-Leninist, that seeks to control information, that denies freedom of speech, and they can see where the social media in TikTok and in our own country, social media, where the Houston Rockets, in particular on this case study, were not allowed to be free, that particular example needs to be communicated to our business community, through our business schools. You need to have people in our government with a national security perspective. It could be through a think tank like CSIS or Hudson Institute, which communicates a particular session that could be used in a podcast or be used over and over again. I also find that studies that are done in Washington from the think tanks in terms of what has occurred with regard to the Communist Party and how they're dealing with our sports franchises or with our businesses inside China, those examples, because of the transparency of the Trump administration, are actually being studied now, and they'll be coming forth. So I think it's an education. It has to be a campaign going forward, and it gets back into not really trusting what the Chinese do with our sports franchises, with our businesses. And I think we need to continue to have that principled American realistic assessment of China now going forward.
Bob, how bad does this get under a Biden administration?
That's a great question as well. I'm hoping that the Biden administration sees China as it really is. I do know some of the leaders that are coming into the national security realm. I think we have very strong leaders on the Republican side, my previous colleagues as well in the Bush administration, that have a relationship with some of the Biden leadership. I do think Mr. Austin, General Austin, if he's confirmed as the Secretary of Defense, is a no-nonsense, very sober military leader that will have influence in the interagency in Washington, D.C., within a Biden administration. I also think Vice President Biden himself will look at the Pacific. The actual pivot, if you recall, was announced during Mr. Biden's or Mr. Obama's administration, where they looked at the rise of China and what needed to be done with regard to reposturing our forces in China. But I am very, very, I'd say cautiously optimistic they'll stick with a more realistic national security assessment. But if they come up with an engagement and enlargement process that tries to engage China and enlarge China based on the old assumptions of the Kissinger through Obama administrations, that's not going to be good enough.
Well, Bob, we're going to have to leave it right there. So thanks very much for joining us today. There's going to be more on this as the weeks and months pass by. So again, thanks, and we'll chat again very soon. After we take a quick break, Homefront to Battlefront author Frank Lavin joins us for the balance of today's show to talk about the Battle of the Bulge, which started 76 years ago this week. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
It's termite season.
Hi, it's me.
And bugs fear the blue trucks from Essential Pest Control.
Go blue at Essential Pest Control. We'll eliminate those bugs, bees, and termites. And stop paying too much to that national provider. Buy local for great service and affordable rates. Call Essential Pest Control because termites fear the blue.
Run for your life.
Call for the blue trucks from Essential Pest Control, 886-3029. That's 886-3029. Or check online at essentialpest.com.
I'm proud to welcome my good friends at Tucson Iron and Metal Retail to Inside Track as an advertiser. Jamie Kipper and her staff are conservation experts. They sell round and square steel tubing, metal plate and roofing materials, as well as new and used steel, aluminum, and stainless steel to ranchers, artists, interior designers, roofers, and do-it-yourselfers, just like all of the listeners here. Tucson Iron and Metal Retail is open Monday through Fridays, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., and Saturdays, 8 a.m. to noon. Tucson Iron and Steel Retail, 701 East 36th Street. Call 520-209-1576 or go to TucsonIronRetail.com. And when you do call, mention this ad and receive an additional 10% discount on their already great prices.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Wouldn't it be great if political leaders could create that country again? Learn how to do exactly that, one family at a time, with Imus Wilkinson Investment Management. Call me, Eb Wilkinson. IMUSWilkinson.com, 777-1911, 777-1911.
Welcome back to Inside Track. We are very pleased to welcome our special guest for the rest of our special Fighting Tyranny show, Frank Lavin. His book, Homefront to Battlefront, The Story of an Ohio Teenager in World War II, is a great read. Welcome to the show, Frank.
Thanks so much, Bruce. It's great to be with you. And I'm excited to talk about what happened 76 years ago.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me on. Yeah.
You know, my co-host, Eb Wilkinson, just reminded me, he said his dad's favorite holiday coincided with December 16th, the start of the Battle of the Bulge, and it was the Boston Tea Party. Did you know that?
I did not know that. I did not know. We have
1773.
That's a good factoid, I think. So you wrote in your book, From Homefront to Battlefront, to honor the men, you wrote the book to honor the men of Company L, because as you wrote, we're here today because they were there yesterday. Wow. Can you explain what that means to you personally and your connection?
Despite the turmoil we're going through this year with the coronavirus, you know, we have a pretty successful society in America, and there's a lot of economic opportunity. It's a peaceful nation. There's the ability to create and experiment and enjoy life here. So there's a lot of good news in America, despite the problems we all know about this year. Our point is sometimes we take that for granted, and we're here today because people before us, generations before us, made sacrifices and fought that fight. And each generation has had various challenges where foreign powers, dictatorships, tyrannies, terrorist groups attacked us and tried to take that away from us. So let's just, while we count our blessing today, let's also say a prayer for those who came before us.
So your father and his fighting comrades received battle training here, of course, before they left for Europe. But was there anything that could really have prepared them fully for what they faced at the Battle of the Bulge? There were groups that were completely wiped out as the Nazis.
Yeah. By the way, this is the only division in the history of the United States that was completely destroyed. I mean, usually, you know, you can take a battering, you can come out the worst in a battle, but usually there's something that's still sort of intact and you can fight another day. But the only time in U.S. history where an entire division was destroyed and never reconstituted was the 106th Division, which unfortunately was on that very front line between U.S. force and German force. So they got the battering ram of the Wehrmacht attack and so just completely wiped out or taken prisoner. But it was the end of the entire division.
Mm. My father-in-law was one of the Brazier boys who fought in northwest France in the battle for the battle for Brest, France. He never talked about his military service, but his Bronze Star and Purple Heart, which were displayed in the living room at home, displayed his heroism that 19th day of August, 44, in the woods. But slowly as he aged and our two sons did discover some of what his, you know, what he faced, I once asked a really stupid question. I said, Simon, why were you fighting? Was it to defeat Hitler? And he answered, we fought for each other, Bruce, and we fought to fight and live another day.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I, by the way, that answer, I think, is the universal response, meaning, you know, we think of high principles and all of that's true. These kids are definitely patriots, but you ask somebody in a foxhole, what do they do? And they're doing it because they got a foxhole buddy next to them. They've got to take care of his life you are your brother's keeper. So that's the key motivation. And you're right, you're just trying to survive. If you survive one more day, at some point this war is going to get over.
Yeah. And I asked Simon that question, you know, partly because we're Jewish, and I thought maybe Hitler had something, you know, to do with it. You know, we knew something of the bad stuff that was going on. I think your dad was Jewish as well.
Yeah, family's Jewish. Look, if you look at America, before America went into the war, there was widespread disdain for Hitler. I mean, Hitler was broadly viewed as the bad guy for his antics. And don't forget, he had, he Anschluss, he takes over Austria, he takes over part of Czechoslovakia. Right. He's viewed as the bully and a very distasteful guy, and he's a dictator in his own country. Now, we didn't know the true horrors of the Holocaust then, but there's very few people in America who are pro-Hitler. There are small groups who are pro-Hitler, but he's really viewed as a nasty fellow. Now, the debate is not so much on what do you think of Hitler. The debate is, should America do anything about it? Because we're not being attacked. He's threatening Britain. Right. He's threatening France. But we're a few thousand miles away, so why do we have to get into this fight? And that's a ferocious debate in 1939, 1940.
Hmm. Your father was a rifleman in Company L, 335th yeah. Regiment of the 84th Infantry, and he said he considered himself lucky to have survived that battle, didn't he?
Well, his comment was, when he came out of the Battle of Bulge, he said, you know, if I never have a lucky day the rest of my life, I will still die a lucky man, because he had luck to get through that last 100 days of combat, the Battle of the Bulge. And I mentioned his company had casualty rate, Bruce, of over 100%, which I was, when I'm going through the military archives, I said, well, how is this? This has got to be a typo or a math error. You can't have over 100% casualty. And I had to ask the military, the archivist, would you explain this to me? And she said, yeah, here's what this means. It means somebody in this unit is killed or taken out of action, and their replacement comes, and that person's killed too. And their replacement's killed too. So the point is, you can have 100 people in a company, and you can have casualty of 150 people. So your casualty rate exceeds your total population, right? Replacements get killed, and their replacements get killed.
Yeah, and he was part of a replacement company that came in due to the...
Right, he was a replacement. He was a replacement guy himself. He came in on Christmas Day. The battle breaks out on the 16th, and he's at mess, Christmas mess in Britain on Christmas Day. And that night, by nightfall, they're on the continent. They're in France being shoved on a train to the front. And that's the desperate need for manpower, because we're getting shellacked those first 2 or 3 weeks. The Germans are really clawing into us and really making good headway until we stabilize that front. It is a bloody, bloody mess.
Mm. You have your father's letters home, don't you? You also have his recollections and those of some of the men he served with, official military records. Was there anything that struck you as the most interesting discovery that you made looking at these sort of in the context of all of these things put together?
Well, I'll tell you a few comments. One is, you know, very ordinary people, if I may say that, typical American teenagers, all, you know, good guys, you know, nothing special, their life's nothing special. Remember, these are kids all from the Great Depression. They're finally, the nation's slowly coming out of it by 1940, but their life is a very ordinary life, kind of very ordinary kids. They can rise to moments of bravery and even heroism in difficult circumstances. So you really feel proud as an American when you read about this, to say, these, you know, if you saw these kids on the street corner, you'd say hi to them, and they're the most ordinary groups ever. So that was an interesting observation, that the most ordinary kid in America is nothing special in schoolwork, GPA, none of that, nothing in sports, and all of a sudden this guy's saving his company by a quick act. It was some very, very impressive stories. The other thing that came through this, I just remember one anecdote, if I could share with you. They're still kids, they're still teenagers, even if they're heroes. And there's one day, one moment where the sergeant tells the squad, four guys, hey, we saw some movement up on this ridge, you know, a half mile, this sort of a little hill ridge, saw some movement, has to be a German patrol out there, you guys go out there and check it out. And all four kids go grab the rifles. Not one kid says, well, it's not my turn, or I did it the last time, or something. And everybody knows, look, this is the most deadly thing you can do. We're going out to seek and destroy a German patrol. Then we're going to have 50% casualty rates. These kids come back 2 hours later. Luckily, the patrol had moved out, and luckily they went through those woods. They didn't, so nothing happened. That's a good day's work. No bad news. And just as that as they're reporting in that, the battalion medical officer shows up and says, hey, I've got the medical jackets here on all you guys, and some of you guys need measles shots. Every single kid in that unit, the kids who just volunteered or just gone without question to do into combat and come back, every single kid in that unit lies to the medical officer, says, no, you got the wrong jacket. I just got my shots yesterday. So it's again, it's a typical teenager. Do your job when it's important, but it's okay to lie about getting shots to the doctor's office. And kids are crying, complaining, I'm not going to take your shot. We're going to all get killed tomorrow anyhow. So it's just funny to read about teenagers still being teenagers, even when they can be, you know, they can be heroes when they have to, and they can be teenagers when they can get away with it.
So were you able to get a hold of the quartermaster's reports of those various days for the Company L in terms of what happened? I know we did that with my father-in-law's battle injuries, and it was fascinating reading.
Yeah, did not see specific quartermaster reports, but I can tell you this chain of events, though, Bruce, which is a little bit harrowing. But because they said, look, as you're right, my dad, the war starts on December 16th. My dad's running December 25th. He says, look, for the first week, we're getting resupplied, and if there's a casualty, somebody's taken out, we get a new person. And then for the second week, we're getting resupplied, but it's not a one-for-one replacement. They're not able to, you know, if you lose a few people, you might get one new person in. And so you're losing men. There's attrition there, and it's shrinking. Everybody kind of knows it and sees it. Week three, there's no replacements. That's it. It is tapped out. This is the largest battle the U.S. Army has ever fought, with 600,000 men in combat and 400,000 support troops. So 1 million men in this fight. The point is, you're tapped out. That is 1/8 of all. At that point, there's 8 million men, Americans in uniform in all services in the Pacific and the Atlantic. That's 1/8 of the entire U.S. strength is in this one battle. So there's no extra person to put in there at this point. And they said, and then, so they said, look, we're not getting replacements. We're just shrinking. We're just taking casualties and we're shrinking. And then you start getting, at week four, you start getting interruptions in food and ammunition. And they said, and your sergeant's telling you, you know, four bullets a day, guys, six bullets a day. You know, that's all you've got. Count them out. That's all you've got. Make everyone count. So it is a depressing moment. And you know it. Look, at some day, at some moment, it's going to come to an end, and supply is going to catch up, and things will turn around. But you don't know, is that going to be tomorrow? Is that going to be 2 weeks from tomorrow? So you've got to count out your bullets and count out your K rations and go step by step to try to get through that day.
100,000 men were lost at the Battle of the Bulge from 16 December through February, when the battle finally was cleaned up. How in the heck did this attack happen and basically caught us flat-footed?
Yeah, there were two or three things going on. One is, we had a U.S. Army, U.S. military, and the Allies had a very successful fall of 1944, very rapid advancement right up to the German border. So as soon as we got through the battle that your dad was in, and you know, it moved very, very quickly. And that's great, but there's a little bit of bad news embedded, and the bad news is that you're at the end of your supply lines. The supply lines can't keep up. The infrastructure's bombed. The Germans destroyed a lot. U.S. bombers destroyed a lot. So you are not really able to fully supply and arm people the way you need to. The other thing that's going on is that as soon as Germany shrinks from their territory under their control, shrinks just to the territory of Germany, they no longer are using radios for communication. We had broken their code, but they're not using the radio. They're using the telephone. They can use landlines. So our intelligence drops.
So the Enigma machine was of no value to the Allies at all then, right?
Well, once you get into Germany, you're saying you're fighting the guy in his home territory, and he's not using radio. The Enigma machine is not of any value, exactly as you say. So those are two huge contributing problems. I think the third big problem, the guy really deserves the stigma for this, is Hitler himself is so brazen, which served him well. At some points in his career, it served him well. At this point, you say, listen, you got 100,000 plus people killed, And what was going to happen even if you'd won this battle? I mean, you weren't going to win the war at this point. You weren't going to win the war. So this is a last-ditch effort. You're throwing everything you've got against the Allies. And what in the heck are you doing? You're literally a few months away from committing suicide. This is his last-ditch effort. And you really have to wonder about saying, I mean, this is his high command is asking him. And he's a dictator, so you got to be careful how you say it. But you say, you know, of course we're going to do what you say. But even if we kind of win, what have we done? We've slowed things down a few months and caused enormous embarrassment for the Allies. But they're going to be right back a few months later. So you know, it was the war was a disaster for Germany. It just destroyed the country. But Hitler just didn't have the, I know what you say, the inner balance to be able to say, look, this is over, and let's try to figure a way to end this with minimal casualties. Mm. Sort of went the other direction.
So I read something, and I have not confirmed the research. It was a description of the 84th Infantry Division. They fought in the First World War when they were called the Lincoln Division.
Right.
And in they called themselves the Rail Splitters. Not long after they bumped into the German army on the Siegfried Line, the Nazis, this report says, had a new name for them. It had nothing to do with the biographical background of Abraham Lincoln. The Germans called them the Hatchet Men.
That's right. Why? Well, their insignia, and by the way, this is all, it was an homage to Abraham Lincoln because the original division was constituted by National Guard units that were originally from the states of Lincoln, that he was born in Kentucky, raised in Indiana, grew up to maturity and first political identity in Illinois. So he had three states of sort of parentage or that he could claim, and that's where the National Guards were won from. And then by World War II, we had moved out of this sort of state-level divisions and so forth, and you were just assigned where you were assigned. It was a combat unit. It wasn't based on your geography. So, because you said my dad's from Ohio and he's just assigned to the 84th because they need men. But the insignia out of homage to Lincoln is and he earned a living as a teenager, as a young man before he got into law as a rail splitter. He's splitting logs, and so it's a little their shoulder emblem is a axe going through a piece of timber and splitting it up. It's a nice little just reminder of Abraham Lincoln's background. And you're right, the Germans knew that, and they said, not that the rail splitters, you're the hatchet men or something, and just a term of denigration that they would use.
So people say that history is written by the winners. Just curious about two things regarding the Battle of the Bulge. What do the Germans call the Battle of the Bulge? And we lost 100,000 men. How many men did they lose?
Oh, that's a great question. That second one on German casualties. But let me go to the first one first. It was called Wacht on Rhein, Watch on the Rhine, right? So it was Rhine facing or Rhine protecting kind of initiative was the ethos behind it. It was. But they took quite a pounding. The U.S. and some British troops in there too. U.S. lost the Allies say lost about 100,000. The Germans lost about 160,000 casualties total. So they took quite a shellacking in this. And again, it was just utterly pointless to be doing this in December 44, January 45 when you were surrounded by all of the Allies on the Western Front, and you've got the Soviets on the Eastern Front, and anybody who can do simple math knows that this thing is going to be over sooner rather than later.
So let's go back to the beginning when the Nazi forces broke through. I think you write in the book that Hitler figured it would take Eisenhower about 2 weeks to react and coordinate a counterattack. Was this a miscalculation?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think something that the dictators sometimes don't fully get is how American society works, because we, to the outsider, we can look sort of so disorganized or haphazard, or maybe that's fair, but it's got there's a lot of resilience and a lot of creativity too. Hitler said, look, it's going to take him 1 week to fully understand what's going on. It'll take him a second week to coordinate. He's the supreme commander. He has to coordinate primarily between London and Washington, D.C. He's got to go to FDR and Churchill. He's got to go back and get permission and figure out a plan. So I've got 2 weeks running room. But history tells us it was very different. The same day that Hitler started his attack, December 16th, Eisenhower's detaching units from Patton's army group and throwing them to battle. I mean, he knew the same. He didn't know exactly what was going on, but he knew something was going on. And this army that he'd been beating back and back and back for several months from D-Day until December, he'd been pushing these guys back. All of a sudden, they were pushing us back. So he knew that day one, and he didn't know how much, but he told George Patton, his subordinate, we're taking some of your divisions away, and we're going to throw them against the German front, whatever's going on there. So he moved very, very quickly. And this was a U.S. trump card because we had such a preponderance of force there, but it does take a while to mobilize forces. And you had that famous 101st Airborne,
right,
was on leave in Paris, and they had to be taken out of Paris. Leave is over, fellas. We're going to the front, and they had to be going to the front, and they didn't have winter clothes. They didn't have ammunition, and they're taking ammunition off the retreating. There's retreating army units they're passing as these guys are going in, and there's the fellas who end up in Bastogne. So they had to just grab what they could grab off the road, off of other GIs. Give me your code, give me your ammo belt, and we're going in, and they held Bastogne.
So one last question for you, because we're going to need to wrap up. When did your grandparents finally know your father's fate, that he was safe, and what were things like in Canton, Ohio, where your dad grew up in that last year, that winter of 44?
I think it was a dreadful time. My dad had one sibling, a brother, and he was serving the Navy in the Pacific. So you're the grandparents, you're the mom and dad back home in Ohio. You only have two kids, and they're both on the front. They're both in battle. But as my grandmother told me, look, but that was every household had that. We had something like 8 million people. So everybody who had military-age kids, every kid in the country's in service. But I think it had to be a wrenching time. I mean, I know as a parent, if my kid is 5 minutes late, you start to get a little twitchy. Or you hear the kid bite, fill off their bike and skin their knee. You say, oh, my God, let's see. So, I mean, you know how it had to be just a wrenching, painful time. But the entire country was mobilized for war. All the industries, we know there's food rationing. You're planting victory gardens. You have to save scrap metal. Kids at school, I remember my dad's a high school senior at Pearl Harbor Day, so he graduates a few months later. He turns 18 and he enlists when he turns 18 as a high school graduate. But their high school class gift is they bought a Packard ambulance for the ambulance corps, right? That's what they all chipped into. Or you say our class gift nowadays, God knows what, we might do something for ourselves, we might do something nice for the school, a new computer lab or something. But that's the whole country's in this mission to save democracy and to save America, beat Hitler and beat Japan.
Well, Frank, we're going to have to leave it there for today. Thanks so much for appearing on the show.
It's fascinating.
Bruce, you're kind to have me on. If people want to take a look at that home front to battlefront, I'd be delighted and look forward to getting people's opinions. And I'm on LinkedIn if people want to chat about it. Thanks so much, Bruce, for having me on.
You bet. And they can find the book on Amazon and go look up Frank Lavin. He gave a couple of great talks, one at the Nixon Library and one, I think, at the Army Institute. Am I saying that right?
Army War College.
These are fabulous. I think you really enjoy it. So thanks very much. And hey, just real quick news before we go out today. We got great news from Onita Davis about Wreaths Across America. They were able to get enough donations to fill all of the veterans' cemetery places at our big cemetery up in Marana. And thanks to Frank for his participation today, and also Bob Wells. I enjoy the security update from him. And until next Saturday, when we have a new show for you, reviewing 2020 for Inside Track, this is Bruce Ash and Eb Wilkinson wishing you a very pleasant good afternoon. Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus.
A lot of the cities and the counties around have initiatives for artists. I think we're one of the premier artist suppliers for steel. First Saturday of every month, you can come down early and actually go through the scrapyard across the street. It's 7 acres of metal. You can walk through with our people and pick out what you want. It's always interesting to see what the artists have done. We've done actually a couple projects with the U of A Engineering Department and Music Department, where the engineering music students came down together. They had to pick something out of the scrap, and they had to build an instrument. And we have one of those in front of the plant. Some really cool things come out of the scrap.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
I'm Eb Wilkinson with Imus Wilkinson Investment Management. I don't ever want you to be dependent on government ever again. I want you to become financially independent. You will never, ever have to depend on socialist security for your survival. We are here to guide you to financial independence. That's imuswilkinson.com, 777-1911. That's 777-1911.